Welcome to Georgia Today. This podcast features the latest reports from the GPB newsroom. On today's episode, a federal judge hears arguments over foreign students targeted for deportation, allegedly without due process. Activists call for an end to high-speed police chases after a fatal crash in Atlanta. And we'll hear how language barriers can put older adults at risk in our healthcare system.
En Selec me sentí bastante abandonada.
I felt abandoned.
Today is Thursday, April 17th. I'm Peter Biello, and this is Georgia Today. A federal judge in Atlanta heard a case today that would grant temporary protections to foreign students whose visa records had been removed by the federal government. GPB's Sarah Callis reports.
With over 130 plaintiffs, the case is the largest to go before a judge as foreign students across the country are facing visa cancellations. The students' attorneys say their clients are caught in status limbo and fear more action will be taken against them. They are asking the court to grant a temporary restraining order to restore protections until a final decision is made. Immigration lawyer Charles Cook says the students are legally entitled to due process.
When the government doesn't follow the rules, it requires people to stand up. That's what these students are doing.
Attorneys for the federal government argued no real harm had been done to the students and that they could follow a reinstatement procedure. Federal Judge Victoria Calvert said she is inclined to grant the temporary restraining order, but is giving both sides time to file more information before she makes a ruling. For GPB News, I'm Sarah Callis in Atlanta.
The case of these students has spawned protests around the state. Speaking at the University of Georgia yesterday, math professor Joseph Fu said he's never seen this level of uncertainty among students and faculty alike.
At 67 years old now, never in the United States have I seen this. Never have I ever imagined this would happen.
Protests also have taken place at Emory and Georgia State Universities. Activists are calling for an end to high-speed chases by law enforcement after a fatal crash in Atlanta on Monday. A 19-year-old not involved in the chase was killed. Democratic state lawmakers and others gathered yesterday to ask Governor Brian Kemp to restrict the Georgia State Patrol's use of high-speed chases. Among those was Kate Weaver, a family friend of the victim.
This fatal accident could have been prevented.
Recent reporting by the Atlanta Journal-Constitution found that state troopers engaged in more than 6,000 pursuits over the past 5 years, leading to almost 2,000 injuries and 63 deaths, many involving bystanders or passengers. A Kemp spokesman blamed the deaths on, quote, those who break the law and act recklessly. Language barriers are putting older adults at risk in the healthcare system. Without an advocate, Georgians who cannot speak or understand English well are more likely to suffer abuse and neglect. GPB's Ellen Eldridge has more.
Luz Ospina spent 38 days in a long-term acute care facility last year. She was only supposed to be there long enough to wean off a ventilator after an Atlanta hospital discharged her. The 73-year-old was diagnosed with myasthenia gravis, a neuromuscular disease, after a trip to the ER.
That led to respiratory failure. That's why she was on a ventilator.
That's Ospina's daughter, Linda Perez. She's the one who fought to get Ospina transferred back to the hospital. Her mother wasn't improving in the long-term care facility, and she couldn't explain why because of a language barrier.
En Selec me sentí bastante abandonada.
I felt abandoned.
Despite laws requiring translation services, doctors there spoke only in English.
There was one person, maybe, that made a small effort to try to communicate with her, but the norm was no communication in Spanish.
Ospina was left with little more than body language, and her mental health declined. Every few days, a psychiatrist stopped by and asked Ospina the same questions. Was she depressed?
Y siempre me decía, ¿usted está deprimida? Yes, I am.
That much she could confirm in English, but deeper communication in Spanish wasn't possible. Perez insisted the facility provide interpretation services.
And they brought a phone with a cable that was so short that you couldn't even get the phone close to the patient.
Ospina's chart didn't match what Perez was seeing.
When I read the reports, it's like, patient is fine. She's fine. She's fine. And he didn't even use the translation line.
Then, her mother was prescribed anti-anxiety medication.
You should ask a neurologist what happens to a patient with myasthenia gravis that receives Xanax twice a day. she could have died.
Almost 1.5 million Georgia residents speak a language other than English at home. And under Title VI of the Federal Civil Rights Act, healthcare facilities must provide interpretation services. Plus, studies show that older adults with language barriers are at increased risk of hospital readmission. Sun-Yun Choi Moro is with the National Asian Pacific American Women's Forum. She says the services aren't as common as they should be. And while it's tough enough to find Spanish translation services, her parents speak Korean.
My dad ended up needing emergency brain surgery. And that whole experience was so traumatic for them that they decided to move back. They did not want to deal with the medical system here.
Choi Moro says language barriers mean more stress on family caregivers.
Even if my dad can understand most of what the doctor says, he still wants me there because he wants to be sure.
The Georgia Department of Community Health regulates long-term acute care facilities in the state. Anyone can file a complaint with DCH online. If a lack of interpretation services leads to death or serious injury, the healthcare facility could be subject to a fine of up to $1,000. Perez fought to get another neurologist to send her mother back to the hospital. Ospina says she felt better immediately after.
Me sentí muchísimo mejor.
Perez believes her advocacy saved her mother's life.
But there are so many people that don't have advocates.
It's a year later, and Ospina no longer needs to steady herself with a walker.
Sorpresa.
She gets around just fine. Perez is happy her mom is okay, but she won't forget the families still struggling in silence. For GPB News, I'm Ellen Eldridge.
Enrollment at Georgia's public colleges and universities reached an all-time record for the spring at about 345,000 students. The University System of Georgia's Vice Chancellor of Research and Policy Analysis reported the numbers yesterday. They are up from last year after declining in 2022 and 2023. The largest growth was among undergraduates, with a 14% increase over last spring. Master's degree programs grew by 12.5%. Also yesterday, the Regents voted to name Georgia Tech School of Public Policy after former President Jimmy Carter and former First Lady Rosalynn Carter. Jimmy Carter attended Georgia Tech in 1942. The Atlanta Writers Club and the Georgia Writers Museum have presented the Townsend Prize for Fiction. The award has been given every 2 years since 1981 and recognizes an outstanding novel or short story collection written and published while the author lived in Georgia. It's named for Jim Townsend, founding editor of Atlanta Magazine. The 2025 winner, announced on Thursday, is Deneen Milner for her book One Blood. She spoke with GPB's Orlando Montoya.
This book is... it's a figment of my imagination, but it is very much rooted in all the things that I ever wanted to know about my own mother.
One Blood traces four generations of Black mothers, their trials and secrets. It was selected by committees of in-state and out-of-state readers from among 10 finalists and presented at a gala on Thursday at the Callenwald Fine Arts Center in Atlanta. George Weinstein of the Atlanta Writers Club says the Townsend Prize celebrates the future of Georgia writers.
The next Alice Walker is writing her, you know, her great work right now. The next Terry Kay is out there working right now. It's a wonderful time to be in Georgia, working with writers and trying to help them succeed.
GPB's podcast Narrative Edge, a podcast about books with Georgia connections, featured Deneen Milner and her book One Blood. You can listen to all episodes of Narrative Edge by searching for it wherever you get your podcasts. The most recent episode of Narrative Edge features a poet, Ellie Bookman. She's a teacher of language arts at Padilla School in Atlanta. Her book, Lovesick Century, is a collection of poems that beautifully contrasts words and images around big ideas. She spoke with GPB's Orlando Montoya.
So I understand you had journalistic parents. Can you tell me a little bit about if that influenced your writing as a child?
Yes, both my parents were journalists, and actually my grandfather was as well, my mother's father. And it definitely influenced me in the sense that the written word was always very revered in our household. And as I was growing up, I wrote all the time. I didn't really discover poetry until later. And so in high school, for example, I still was pretty interested in maybe pursuing journalism. I was really active in my high school newspaper. And my father kind of cautioned me against it, not to say that I shouldn't do it, but just to say, you know, it's a hard field. Just make sure you think about it. And I went off to college and chose poetry instead, which was not exactly an easier field, right?
An even harder field, perhaps.
Right.
Well, let's talk about the book, Love Sure. Sixth Century. What was the idea behind the book?
The idea was I wrote all these poems over many years, pretty much close to a decade, really. And the idea was, how do they all come together? And I do believe they do come together. I think over the course of writing them all, I figured out some things, or I came to a deeper understanding of some things about the world and how I see the world.
Now, I sort of got a couple of themes from this book, but before I get into what I thought they were, mm-hmm. I'll ask you, what do you think are the themes that bind these poems together?
I mean, the title's a big clue, love and sickness, and love sometimes means romantic love within the book, but it also just means the human impulse to seek connection with another human. And then sick is sort of the darker side of that coin, which is when you are so hungry to hold on to and keep those connections or keep whatever it is you have, that can become a sort of darker impulse.
It's a very topical book, I must say. There's a
yes.
lot of topical references in there, even though we're not specifically pointing out, you know, news headlines.
No, it's very purposefully. I mean, I look at the news a lot of the time. Maybe that's to go back to the journalism theme. I look at the news a lot when I'm sitting down to write. And I don't, you know, I don't put the name of an event or the name of a person in a poem, but I might read a headline and feel very confused and conflicted and hurt or some kind of emotional response to a news event, and then I try to write the poem out of that.
Ones that that stood out to me, the first, of course, is the opener, Today.
Mm-hmm.
It starts, "Today a war started, but thousands more were already in bloom, so it felt like going for groceries." It's almost a statement of how has war become so common.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, what's more common than just going and buying groceries? And the poem lists several of the most basic kinds of groceries, including frozen pizza. And I think that's what I was going for, is that strangeness of a poem that acknowledges that wars are happening all over the world. And yet you could just be going about your business buying a frozen pizza. The first few poems bring in the theme of war and violence, which has always been a fascination of mine, not in a good sense necessarily, but I've always been obsessed with trying to understand why wars happen. And then the theme of sort of falling in love is in that first section as well. And it's equally as loud in some ways. So there's that really violent example of war juxtaposed with the feeling of falling in love and forming a deep connection.
The other one, let me see, was Living Alone.
Mm-hmm. That one has a sort of clever opening that people tend to like.
"I will be a woman with a drill, not a woman with a neighbor with a drill."
Yes.
Were you ever a woman with the drill or the woman with a neighbor with a drill?
Oh, I was the woman with the drill, of course. That's the resolution that the poem makes. I think the first time I was living alone, this is one of the oldest poems in the book, actually. This was written while I was in graduate school and I was living on my own. And I had to install a window air conditioning unit by myself because I had no air conditioning in North Carolina in August. And I had to go buy a drill to be able to get it into the frame of my window. And then I wrote this poem about that experience.
I think I liked it because I lived alone for many number of years, and it's sad in a way,
mm-hmm.
but you learn to live with it, and you do things on your own.
You get skills that you wouldn't get otherwise because you have no other option, right? You mm-hmm. have nobody else to ask to help you with installing the air conditioner or fixing the sink or whatever it might be, so... there's a strength, I think, that comes from it. And it is a sad poem in a way, but in a lot of ways, but it also is a celebration of that strength that comes from that kind of experience.
So tell me about your New Yorker break. How did that happen?
That was so very exciting. I submit poetry all the time. I submit to every magazine that I would ever want to be published in, and usually I expect rejection. So it was one random summer afternoon. I submitted a group of poems to The New Yorker and then forgot about it and thought I would never hear anything back. So that was in the summer. And I think it was in January of 2017, I think it was, when I got an email back from them saying, we would like to publish one of these poems. The poem was Privilege. It didn't actually appear in the magazine until that August. But it was a thrill seeing it there. And I've had two poems published there again since. And it's always a really exciting thing.
And now you're a teacher, so mm-hmm. that's a lesson for your kids.
Yeah. I actually usually start my school year, every time I have a new group of students in front of me, I tell the story of how that poem was written, how I submitted it and revised it and edited it, how I waited and how I, you know, the anticipation and the excitement. And I tell them that whole story of from the first draft to publication to kind of earn some credit with them that as a writer, you know, it's a difficult path, but it's so rewarding. And I want to kind of show them that it's possible and show them that I at least know a little bit about what I'm trying to teach them.
Okay, Ellie Bookman, your collection of poems is called Love, Sixth Century. Thank you so much for coming and speaking with us.
Thank you so much. It's been wonderful.
And that's it for Georgia Today. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you want to learn the latest updates on all the stories you've heard, go to gpb.org/news. And remember to subscribe to this podcast. We are off tomorrow, but we'll be back in your feed on Monday afternoon with all the latest news from Georgia. And your feedback is welcome. Send it via email. The address is georgiatoday@gpb.org. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you so much for listening.